Hi, I'm Megan Riley, and I am not your normal relationship and sex coach. Remember how he used to look at you? Let's get that back. This isn't going to be about texting the right thing or manipulating him. It's about changing you and you becoming more you. And I am going to be here to help every step of the way. This is the Ignite the Fire podcast. Hi, beautifuls. Welcome back. Today, I have Dr. Loretta Bruning, PhD, and I found her from the book Habits of a Healthy Brain. So today, we talk about a whole bunch of stuff, but the happy brain in relationships and sexuality and the brain that is on default in relationships and sexuality. And I think this is big because if we can learn how to rewire our brain, especially in the one relationship that triggers us more than any relationship that there is, and the one relationship that is the most about our healing and about our recovery and who we can be and how we can be an even bigger person, this is the secret sauce. So Dr. Bruning is the founder of the Inner Mammal Institute, which provides resources that help people rewire their mammalian neurochemistry. She's professor at California State University, East Bay, and author of a bunch of books. You can find her at Inner Mammal Institute, and I would recommend all of her books, and especially Habits of a Healthy Brain. Enjoy. Dr. Bruning, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me and for raising these great topics with people.
Academic, you're a PhD. How did you come to this world?
This world, for people who don't know, so this world is the Inner Mammal Institute and the brain chemicals that we've inherited from earlier animals and how they cause our good feelings and how also they cause our bad feelings and what is our power over them. So I had studied social sciences my whole life, and then I had issues with my students and my kids that were not answered by social science. And the more I discussed this with my colleagues, the more I felt like they were in a fantasy that was not working. And I so many professors' children are not learning to read. And yeah, and their theories are like, oh, well, some people are deprived, but no, it's not just deprived people, you know. So I thought, whoa, this whole social science model is missing something. And that's when I got very motivated to read more and more. And I read little bits about the animal brain, and a little bit here and a little bit there, and no one had connected the dots. But all throughout the 20th century, there was a huge profusion of animal research, which has now suddenly become taboo. But it's that animal research that I delved into, and I even started collecting all of those paleo books that are not widely available on the internet and sort of mined the knowledge that was there.
So what inspired the Inner Mammal Institute?
The idea that other people would want to learn this, and maybe I figured that out in a sort of negative way, which is I found myself lecturing people because people sit around and complain all the time, and they blame X, Y, and Z, and they don't see how their own neurochemicals are causing really natural behaviors that are ubiquitous in nature. And if people could only see that, then they would have more power over these patterns. But, you know, when you're in a social situation, it's not nice to lecture people. So I thought, I really got to write this in a book so that I could just put it all together and leave people alone.
Now, your book.
Habits of a Happy Brain. I have a lot of books, but yes.
A lot of books. This is the one that where I found you, and I was so inspired. And to really take on 45 days of how to have brain and brain chemicals work for me. And then I can share it with people. In your book, it says your upbringing was not happy. And I think a lot of us, a lot of the women that are listening are in a similar boat and really have been trying to find a way to make it work, if that's through pharmaceuticals. For me, for a long time, it was self-medicating, how to have just really like function and be happy. So how has that changed for you?
Everyone's situation is very individual. So we're all born with billions of neurons, but almost no connections between them, which is very unusual because animals, like a reptile, leaves home the instant it's born. And if it doesn't leave fast enough, a parent eats it because they are already hardwired with survival skills. But humans are born with no survival skills. We, you know, a baby can't even put its hand in its mouth for a month or two, you know, three. I just had a grandchild. And so we're born unwired, and we wire ourselves by interacting with the environment. And we all are born needy, and we're all designed to learn to meet our own needs before our parents die. Otherwise, species couldn't survive. I think the problem today is that people have gotten idealized notions of what life is like. They expect idealized happiness. There's some like idealized idea of mental health. And if I don't have that, something is wrong with me, or something is wrong with the healthcare system for not giving it to me. The idealized spouse or partner that is going to make you happy all the time and is going to fit your idea of perfect mental health, and have the idealized children and idealized boss and idealized life. And so I think this is a problem. So if you ask what changed for me, so first, where I started was unique, just like where everyone started was unique. So I started in a way of I learned to be invisible. And I did that because when I asked for attention, it made things worse because my mother was very emotionally challenged. So she had a really horrific life. I did not. The only problem I had was that my mother was often distraught and sort of wanted to cry on my shoulder. So many people have had other situations. Like one person asks for attention a lot, and that person maybe got attention from doing bad things. And some people didn't get attention from the parents, so they bonded with other children. So there's so many different variations of how this can happen. And I say that because I don't want anyone to think that I'm like promoting my path in any way. But my path happened to be I could close the door to try to not trigger my mother, but the walls were thin, so I couldn't protect myself from hearing her crying and screaming. And if I went out, she'd get mad at me. So I learned to read. So I'd sit in my room and read to sort of block it out. So that skill served me well. And in fact, I learned a very profound self-control that served me well. And of course, I wouldn't wish that on a child, but I have observed that the other extreme, which I initially raised my kids with, which, you know, the Rousseauian idea that children are born wise and all-knowing and they're always right and we should always put the child first and put ourselves below them. And then you've probably gone out to a restaurant and seen a family where some little toddler is in charge.
Yes.
So children are born unwired animals, and it's a challenge to wire up, and we need to face this challenge without these idealized notions that there is some perfect way of being wired up and everything else is a disaster. So we all just got our own quirky neural circuits, and we all have to learn to work with them. And we can stop keeping score for other people and just focus on our own circuits.
Oh, that's so great. Do you remember The Ideals magazine from the 70s and 80s?
No.
That was like my picture of perfect. I guess it would, now we could relate it to Martha Stewart or something, but it was pictures of perfectly made meals, pictures of families, everybody's happy, sitting around the table. Like this, in my mind, this is what life should be like.
And on one level, it's healthy to want more. And we could talk about, so our brain is designed to seek. And all through human history, people had so little food that all their energy got invested in seeking food. And then they had to seek a mate. And then they instantly got kids and they had to seek food for the kids. And then they were dead. And so you didn't have this energy to go much beyond that. So today, our basic needs are met so easily that we have all this seeking energy. And it's just a challenge to figure out how to use it in a way where we're not overly shaken by disappointment. So here's the thing, in the state of nature, if you seek food and you don't get it, that's a survival threat. Like when a lion goes after a gazelle and it doesn't get the gazelle, it's a survival threat. If our, you know, caveman ancestors trekked for miles and didn't find food, it was a disaster. So our brain is designed to see disappointment as a disaster. So we seek, we get disappointed. We seek, we get disappointed. So how could we be cool with that? So that's the idea.
Oh, so this is about relationships and sex. We seek. We get disappointed.
Yes, yes, yes.
Cray Cray Town, where women go, right? We seek and then we put all the attention onto him or her.
Yes, yes, yes.
We give them all the anchoring and we give them all the responsibility for them having us feel good. Then it doesn't work out and it's disaster.
Yes, exactly. And with all my list of all the things we idealize, you brought up another really good one, which is like the idealized sex life.
Yes.
That's another thing that's been burdened with people. And this illusion that other people are having this idealized sex life. So just to get to the point, so a better way of looking at things is that everything is a trade-off. And if you have more of something, then you have less of something else. Nobody likes to think that. Nobody's told that. But it's so obvious. So with each of the happy chemicals, you know, you could see how all of these trade-offs are inevitable. But, you know, with sex, the simple example is that a new partner has certain advantages, but then a constant parade of new partners has certain disadvantages. An old partner has certain advantages and certain disadvantages. So that's the facts of life. And when you stop blaming your partner for the facts of life, that's very liberating.
Oh, how great. So what do? We have a partner. And in our sex life, in our relationship life, there are certain advantages to that. How do we make this work for us?
You mean the partner that has been around a while and is feeling less than perfect?
Yes.
We may as well look at it from the perspective of the happy chemicals. So dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, endorphin, we'll see if we have time for it. So dopamine is the joy of when you're about to meet a need. So it's finding something that meets your needs. It's approaching a reward. So when you don't have a partner and then you have an opportunity, you have a first date, you have a second date, that's like dopamine, 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 because it's a big need. And the bigger the need, the more the dopamine. It would be like if you're dying of thirst in the desert and you see an oasis, that's like huge dopamine. But in the modern world, if you have unlimited running water, it doesn't make you a bit happy. So it's sort of like if you don't have anyone to give you a hug, then that one hug at the end of the date is like a big deal. But when you have someone who hugs you every day, that doesn't trigger your dopamine anymore. Mm-hmm. So is it their fault? No, you have to find other ways to trigger your dopamine and not other people to hug you, but other new things that you could seek, that you could get excited about. And you could say, I'm so lucky that I have someone to hug me, that I'm going to seek something in a different area of my life now that I have luxury of a nice base of support. But when you say a nice base of support, so I go off and I seek this new thing, and then I come home and I tell my partner about it, and they're not understanding because it's not their goal. And I mean, I really understand how frustrating it is. You know, you have this new goal, you're excited about it, and they're not getting excited about it, and they don't understand your frustrations. But then I have to tell myself, wait a minute, I don't get excited about his goal. I don't get sad about his disappointments because our circuits are so individual and your dopamine is not my dopamine. So we can be considerate and I can make an effort to get excited with my partner about their ups and downs. And I know that women do that more than men, but I think feminism has taken it to an extreme. I think there's a value in the male approach, which is you don't have to merge with other people suffering all the time. The male idea of like, okay, you had that disappointment, so let's focus on the next step. I like that.
Yes. How we connect if we don't have women, if we don't have a place to what I call unpack, then what we're doing is just complaining.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing is when women get together with other women, they complain a lot. And men often don't complain because any weakness would be disrespected. So there's advantages to complaining and there's disadvantages to complaining. So once again, everything is a trade-off and we can find balance. And once again, you can't find balance from pills, like this new concept that your chemicals are unbalanced and the doctor can fix it for you. It's just not realistic because these chemicals did not evolve to flow all the time for no reason. So what I explain in my books is that in the monkey world, it's so easy to see that the chemical turns off in a very specific situation. It's designed to motivate a survival behavior. And then when that moment is over, then the chemical stops and you have to create another survival need that you meet in order to stimulate more of it.
Huh. And dopamine, this is the one that is connected with the receptors to cocaine, correct?
Exactly.
Okay, so for those of us who were in that new relationship, repeat, and I haven't hidden at all my struggles with drugs and alcohol, this is the one where we keep trying to find that hit, that high.
Yes, but everyone has their own way of doing it. One person might do it with substances, another might do it with love addiction or both. You know, some people do it with gambling, some people do it with work. They're like they're obsessive over work, you know. Other people are like codependent and they are like constantly trying to control someone else to get their hit. Mm. Some people are collectors and they always gotta look for another something. Like when I finish writing a book, I want to write another book. And so I had to work really hard to say, okay, I'm going to not write another book. I'm going to have an empty space and have the courage to face this empty space just to free myself of that feeling that there's only one way to trigger your dopamine. And food, of course, many people do it with food.
Yes. Bulletproof coffee for me every morning, looking forward to my bulletproof. That is a need being met.
Yeah. We all can see how whatever it is, you think of it, oh, I would love another one of those. And to say, that's what helped our ancestors survive. Because when they woke up in the morning, they had no refrigerator, they had no supermarket, they had to search constantly for food. And that's that seeking brain that we've inherited. But we're like the first generation that has this base of security. So we have so much seeking energy. And it's so hard to direct it in a healthy way.
There was a comment in your book about why not just be with the cortisol instead of looking for the next hit. And that really struck me because we have our needs met for the most part. And any kind of uncomfortable feeling in my body, I want to find a way through it.
Yes. So very good. Thanks for remembering that. So being with the cortisol for a moment is hard for a few reasons. And I go into this more in my next book, which is called The Science of Positivity, which is why negativity is natural. So as we know, in the state of nature, there was so much potential threat that cortisol evolved to be like really uncomfortable. Like you really feel like it's an emergency and you can't focus on anything else. You just got to relieve that cortisol. So I'm not saying we should go to the other extreme of totally ignoring, because then you know people are like they're stressed all the time, but they try to ignore it and they're not dealing with it. But the idea is when you practice ignoring it for 1 minute, that it helps you figure out what's triggering it. And for most people, it's social anxiety. So the idea like that social anxiety is a disease that the doctor can fix for you is not very helpful. To understand it better, we need to know two things. So one is the other happy chemicals, oxytocin and serotonin, are very much about meeting social needs. And in the animal world, life and death implications of social needs that I'll explain. But the other thing that we need to know is that our neural pathways sort of got set in high school. So the social anxiety of high school is the lens through which we all see life.
Oh.
And that's why we all default to the social anxiety of high school. And even, like I said, high school is a new thing. Like 100 years ago, almost nobody went to high school. It's mind-boggling. So, you know, 100 years ago, you'd be apprenticed to a blacksmith. And then it's like, you learn the skill by repeating it. If you do it wrong, you bang your hand. So you learn to do it better. Or the blacksmith kicks you out and then you starve, you know? Mm-hmm. So we learn from real consequences. So people who complain now about tests and high school drama, it's really so much easier than the world of child labor, but people don't get it. Let's quickly do oxytocin and serotonin. So oxytocin is the chemical that rewards you with a good feeling when you have social trust. So once again, the idealized vision of social trust is that there's some idealized utopia where everybody trusts everyone else, and I can trust everybody and everybody trusts me and no one ever hurts your feelings, which never existed and never will exist and certainly does not exist in the animal world or the child world or the teen world. So the brain evolved to make careful decisions about when to trust and when not to trust. So a small-brained animal, like a gazelle, it has its herd, and it trusts its herd because it grew up in that herd, and it doesn't trust other herds. And when it's with its herd, its oxytocin turns on, and then it lowers its guard because it's sharing the burden of vigilance, and it's like you feel surrounded by protection. But it's not like one for all and all for one, because gazelles try to push their way into the center of the herd so that the other gazelle gets eaten. So, you know, when many people, like, you want to have a group of friends, but then you feel like, oh, are these really my friends? And that frustration is natural and it is frustrating. But the bottom line is that your friends are all promoting their own survival, just like you're promoting your own survival. We all have oxytocin circuits built from our early experience that tells us who to trust and who not to trust. And those signals are not the absolute truth, because they're just built from the random chance of whatever happened to you when you were young. So we all have to make a careful effort of, like, understanding what our oxytocin signals are and knowing that we have the power to build new oxytocin circuits. Now, I'll just quickly go on to the serotonin thing, because that's like a giant piece of our reality. So to make it really short, mammals live in groups and their groups have status hierarchies. And I know this is very upsetting to people. Nobody likes to think of cute furry animals having status hierarchies, but they do. And any extra energy they have, they put into raising their status. And when they do that, it stimulates their serotonin and they feel confidence and strength and calm, because when you're in the position of strength, you are safer because you have better access to food and mating opportunity. And that's what they seek. And that's what we seek. And nobody likes to admit this, but everybody sees it in other people. It's like, oh, they just want status and power and strength. So, and they feel good about being in the position of advantage. But when you are in the position of advantage, you feel good. And so you seek it and seek it and seek it. But the bottom line is that when someone else has a position of advantage, even for a moment, that's not a survival threat, but it feels like a survival threat. So when someone else has a slightly better sex life or a slightly better job, or if your boss is slightly nicer to someone else, or if your mate looks at someone else. So we're constantly keeping score because of the urge for serotonin that we've inherited in our mammal brain. And that's the subject of my book, I Mammal.
Serotonin. So the pharmaceuticals are saying, and I had in my looking for trying to feel happy for many, many years, serotonin upticks, so that we should constantly have serotonin flowing in our brain. And then it sounds more like dopamine. I love roller coasters. I love music festivals. I love all those things. And I would say that that's serotonin seeking. It sounds like what you're saying is normal.
Let me explain. Okay, I think they're different things. So roller coaster is adrenaline. So I don't go much into adrenaline because adrenaline is like an emergency signal. And there are good emergencies and bad emergencies. If someone calls you and tells you you won the lottery, some people grow up liking that emergency feeling. Mm-hmm. And excitement distracts you from whatever's going on. Depending on your early experience, like for some people, like let's say your family was sitting around and things were not nice, and then some excitement came along. So you got to like excitement. In my family, like I would get hit if there was excitement. So I got to hate excitement. So we're all just individual. But music festival is oxytocin. I just wrote a New Year's Eve thing about cheering. When you're with people and you all cheer together,
yes,
that feeling of, I can trust all these people because they get excited about the same thing as me. And sadly, in most of human history, people got that tribe herd feeling from war. So people don't realize that for most of human history, each tribe was warring against the neighboring tribe all the time. And it was horrible, but we feel good about our tribe when we oppose the other tribe. So a music festival is a great substitute. You get that tribal feeling without the harm of war. And that's what we're all seeking today. Unfortunately, many people are doing it with partisan politics where we're warring against our own country, which I think is horrible. So it's hard to find other ways, but cheering with other people, sports is for many people the way to do that.
Serotonin is not supposed to flow all the time. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. So you're asking about serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Yes.
So here's the thing. In the monkey world, it doesn't flow all the time. But what I have in my iMammal book, it's like 30 synonyms. If you go to my Amazon page for iMammal, there's 30 synonyms. Ego, we're all told that ego is bad. Ego, right. Pride, assertiveness, self-confidence, dignity, feeling important, feeling special, feeling in the one-up position, feeling competitive advantage. So these are all that natural urge. And we want to feel that every minute, because when you feel like you're in the one down position, your brain says, uh-oh, I'm not going to be able to meet my needs because other people are stronger than me. And we don't want to feel that. So that's why, see, a monkey can't think in advance, but a human can think in advance. So that's why when all your other needs are met, you're anticipating, okay, what can go wrong? What can go wrong? So when you see other people are stronger than you, you worry. So then you think, how can I be strong? And that's the serotonin. And so ideally, you create neural circuits that say, I'm strong enough. I'm strong enough. I'm strong enough. I can take care of whatever I need. I don't need to be king of the world. I'm strong enough. But that's idealized. So that's what's hard to do. And every time you say, I'm strong enough, you say, oh, but what if this happens? But what if this happens? But what if this happens? So that's why we have to constantly go back to that confidence in your own strength. But so much of the advice we're getting, I don't think is helpful, because they tell you ego is bad and you should always put yourself below others. So, right. So many people go in for this advice and then they end up being depressed, and then they blame the world, they blame society. And I think that's just a very unhealthy loop.
Yes. I'm so glad you said that. The ego gets us fed. It gets us taken care of, right? Yeah. It gets us laid. It's very, very necessary. Right. And this like it's spiritual necessary. Arrogance.
Exactly. So yes. It's not like everything. It's we want the middle ground. It's not the, like we all, everyone now it's popular to complain about narcissism. It's like when someone else has confidence in their own power, we don't like it because we have urge for confidence in our own power. So it gave me a good way of thinking about it. It's like a bicycle. I have to have focus on my own needs and I have to focus on other people's needs. And you have to keep both wheels going. Can't just have one wheel, can't just have the other wheel. So it's both mm-hmm. wheels.
A lot of women that I talk to have put themselves last for years. And so when we finally start talking about putting first, they may swing a little too far in the pendulum. What is that?
Well, it's a combination of, as I said, they have the idealized notion of what they need. And then all of their history of deprivation that they're perceiving, they're blaming the person in front of them right now for not giving them. And then they're doing it because they're hearing that message repeated. So we're very susceptible to repeated messages. So anybody who tells you over and over, it's their fault that you're not blah, 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 whatever. You believe that because it feels good in the short run. It builds a pathway. So in order to get over that, you'd have to expose yourself to other messages. But nobody's saying the other message because it's not cool. Nobody's saying, hey, women, give your partner a break. Give yourself a break and just be real. So that's what my second book, Science of Positivity, it's about realistic expectations. But nobody's preaching realistic expectation because that's not good recruiting material, you know? And in fact, I'll tell you the truth, not many people are buying the book because who wants realistic expectations?
Well, realistic, but then also vulnerable too. And it's not the ideals. It's not the perfect picture. It's not the perfect sex life and the perfect abs and the perfect, but what's more real and possible.
Well, so here's the middle ground between like, because the vulnerable, that doesn't sound like fun either.
Right.
So the middle ground is small steps, is that I can have better, but instead of having this dream at the top of the mountain, is to focus on my next step. And I can constantly take another step and I can control my steps. So stay focused on what you can control. Break down your needs into small chunks and always define the chunk in a way that you can control rather than the way someone else can control. So then you won't always be angry at other people for depriving you, but you're just busy taking your next step. And then you're constantly feeling good because you're stimulating the chemicals when you're taking the steps.
Okay, this is good. So many women don't even know what they need. When I ask them, what do you need? I suggest that they sit down every day and do time of how am I and what do I need?
Okay. So what I often suggest is a short run goal, a long run goal, and a medium term goal. So the long run goal, you can have your pie in the sky, your dream, whatever. Short run goal is something I can do before lunchtime, before dinner time. So I can always have that great feeling of getting something done on my time horizon. So I know I'm going to have dopamine, you know, in the next short run. And then the medium term goal is like the end of the week or the end of the month. So I always have this feeling of accomplishment. So the bottom line is that you can't always make progress because stuff happens. But if you have a few different goals, then you can always shift between one and the other. So I can always be stepping forward in one of my goals. So I'll give you my personal thing. So I'm a sort of a travel addict and I just love planning my next trip. And so whenever I'm not making progress on other things, I start planning a trip. It was really an addiction, you know, I was constantly planning another trip, but it is something that I can have control over. You know, and I can read TripAdvisor and dream of the next trip, but it's sort of within my time horizon, you know. So yeah. I did have to stop because I realized it was an addiction, but then I started again.
For me, it's jam bands. And I read a great book years ago called Everything I Need to Know About Business I Learned from the Grateful Dead. They knew about dopamine in 1967 or not. Brilliant. But the amount of money and time that I have spent planning and going to shows and like thinking about it and who's going to be there and what's going to happen and all that whole world, that I'm lifelong customer.
And see, this is the thing. And so if a person has like a bad habit associated with the goal that they love, then you can't give up your bad habit because then you lose that goal that you love. And so we do need something that this like organizing principle in our life. For most of human history, that organizing principle was forced on you. And today we have this sort of celebration of youth rebellion where so many people are recruited when they're young into that cult of fight your parents' goals, oppose your parents' goals. And then they never learn healthy self-care because they just learn opposition. I don't agree with this at all. And my next book that I'm writing is for teens because I really don't think this opposition is the thing to do. But if you learn this jam band seeking when you're young, it's a deeply wired neural circuit. It's called myelination. So you read in the book about myelination, which is when you're young, your brain has a lot of myelin. It coats your neurons the way insulation coats a wire, and that makes the wire 100 times more efficient conductor. So whatever we do with our myelinated neurons feels easy and natural and effortless and normal. So when you think, how can I feel good? Oh, I'm going to plan to do X. So then if you say, oh, I can't do X, then how can I feel good? So that's the challenge, is to find new things that you can feel good about that are sustainable. And no one thing is going to feel that good when you're an adult, because an adult knows the downside of everything. And so that's why we need a few different ones.
So all these chemicals in a long-term relationship where honestly we end up blaming our partner for everything that doesn't go right. And maybe they have a facial expression one day that isn't, or they don't want to have sex when we want to have sex, or something. How can we plan these small goal, medium goal, big goal, and have these chemicals work for us?
First, a simple, simplistic answer, what I always say is, my husband gets on my nerves, but they're my nerves. So I have to control them because they're my nerves. So that's the whole thing, is to keep saying, okay, it feels like he's doing it to me, but I am doing it myself. And I have to go back to this over and over because he does get on my nerves. So I'm not, you know, pretending to be, you know, people get on my nerves, you know. Everybody gets on my nerves. So long-term, short-term, medium-term. I would love to say that my husband and I share this common goal, you know, but we don't. And, you know, I try to find a common goal. I try to da-da-da, you know, I try to share, you know. So maybe it will work for other people. Maybe, you know, but I had to say, you know what? I am lucky enough that my husband doesn't dump on my goals. So I think that's the best thing. Now, I can't expect my husband to celebrate my long-term goal or to, like, we want, you know, your partner to get excited about your goal. But reality is that often they don't, because this long-term goal, it takes a lot of energy, and their energy is devoted to their long-term goal. So that's the best we can say, is I want him to have a long-run goal. I want to have a long-run goal. And at minimum, he has to be respectful of my long-run goal and not piss on it. So if he pisses on it, I have to politely say, when I'm in the room, would you please speak respectfully, you know, and not piss on my goal. But they don't have to get excited about it. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's a fine trade-off. Okay. And then I have to do the same. I can't be sneering at his long-run goal. I have to be respectful of it, but I don't have to celebrate it or make it happen or make it my first long-run goal. Now, on the short-run goal side, let's look at. So my husband and I watch a movie every night at 9 o'clock, and I sort of sit in his lap. Because we have this long thing that sort of sitting on the couch, but leaning back on him. So I know that at 9 o'clock every day, I'm going to have absolute complete relaxation. And also I have I will not watch a movie about violence or about somebody slowly dying of cancer or people hating each other or buildings exploding. So I know that every night at 9 o'clock, I'm going to have absolute relaxation. And we have a sort of a polite way of finding a movie that we can both feel good about, even though our tastes are quite different. So that's just an example. Like if I told you the list of things that my husband and I agree on, that would seem very impressive. But then if I told you the things we disagree on, you'd say, oh my God, how can you live together? So I just say each of us has so many different circuits that any one person will agree with us on a lot of stuff and disagree with us on a lot of stuff. So we're all so individual that it's just so hard to get along. And for most of human history, people lived in this tiny hut with a whole bunch of others, you know, and parents and kids, they all slept in the same bed. And then all the kids slept in the same bed. And now kids have their own room. They have their own television. Nobody grows up learning to negotiate. Used to be everybody ate out of the same pot. You had no choice at all over what you ate. Now everybody has all these obsessive food list of rules, you know? Mm-hmm. So we haven't really learned the skills of tolerating other people's individuality. And at the same time, everybody's individuality has grown.
Can we talk about the downside of oxytocin for a second?
Yeah.
So you sit and pretty much sit in your husband's lap and you watch a movie and got that flow going.
Yeah.
Now, if one of you goes for a trip, you're not going to feel that. You're going to go into withdrawal. What do we do about that?
I have other ways of relaxing my body. And one of them is I get a lot of physical therapy. So again, this is very individual. For some people, it's their thoughts. And for some people, it's their physical body and the combination. So we all have physical tension. And I had a lot of early physical injuries. So that's an issue for me. Learning to release your physical tension is a life skill. And you can't hold your partner 100% responsible for your physical tension. So there's other things that a person can do to relieve their physical tension. And it's a real skill because I know that what's popular today, a lot of people quote unquote work out. Mm-hmm. But that becomes like an addiction too. Because then if they're stressed, they have to work out more and more and more and more. And they don't learn to face their demons because they've been indoctrinated that more workout is the only solution. So we all have these, you know, circuits. And so that's knowing that I have a lot of different tools for meeting my needs and my oxytocin needs, my serotonin needs, my dopamine needs, and to know that I have the power to build a new tool if the ones I already have are not serving me.
It's so powerful. I think myself included, but we go into withdrawal and then are searching for something to have it better. If that's exercise.
Yes. Or have it better immediately.
Right? Yes. Instead of really being able to stop and cortisol and then develop a new pathway.
How to
do that.
Exactly. Yeah. So if I'm on a trip, so I have to be really careful about, and I plan in advance, what can I bring on the trip that's going to not be agitating and is going to help me relax? And I never watch the news. I think it's so unhealthy. It's designed to agitate you.
Yes.
Many people I know are addicted to the news and they need to get that anger fix. And that's like the equivalent of what we talked about. The next thing is being defined by some outside agency that is making them feel powerless and angry. So it takes a lot of planning to fill your menu. And that I have a new book coming out called Tame Your Anxiety. And I call it Fill Your Pantry with Anxiety Tamers. Plan it in advance. So when I'm in a bad mood, what can I turn to that is going to be relaxing? Ironically, like one thing I like is comedy, but it's so hard for me to find comedy that doesn't get on my nerves because so much of it is anger-based.
Yes.
So I have to, when I'm in a good mood, I have to go through a long list of comedies to find the one that I can listen to when I'm in a bad mood. And that's so I plan stuff to do for when I'm in a bad mood.
Oh, this is so good because the CDC says that anxiety is double epidemic levels, double. And there's so many people who are medicated or trying to deal with it.
Yeah. But there's also that crisis mongering.
Yes.
Teaching people, and especially teenagers, to feel powerless about their own brain and to just say, oh yeah, I'm part of an epidemic. It's the healthcare system. It's not my fault.
Yep.
It's a disaster to raise people with this mindset.
Yes. Okay. So you have mentioned a lot of books and I just want to say again, Habits of the Brain and the 45-Day Challenge changed my life. If you have not read the book, go through the 45-Day Challenge, and then tell us about your other books.
First, I have to tell you how much I appreciate this. First, you've asked really good questions. Second, I've gotten a little flack on the 45-day thing. So my latest book, I haven't put the 45-day thing. But I agree. It is very powerful because it's just the right time horizon that we need to feel that middle term sense of our own power. So my other books, Habits of a Happy Brain, Retrain Your Brain to Boost Your Serotonin, Dopamine, Oxytocin, and Endorphin Levels. And just very quickly, because you brought up the dopamine is cocaine, serotonin is antidepressants, oxytocin is orgasm and or ecstasy, and endorphin is opioid. I should just quickly explain that I'm mentioning it less. So we are not designed to have opioids on all the time. Endorphin evolved for emergencies only. So when you see on a nature video, and by the way, nature videos are the best thing. I love them. When you see the lion get its claws and the gazelle's flesh is ripped open, but it's still able to run because endorphin evolved to mask pain. And that's its job, to mask pain. It's there for a few minutes. And after that, the animal feels pain because then it's either dead or it needs to withdraw to protect its injuries. And so that's the goal of endorphin, is to temporarily mask pain in emergencies only. We're not designed to seek it. And yet people seek it. Mm-hmm. We are not designed to inflict pain on ourselves in order to get the endorphin. And yet we do.
I have some people with tattoos.
I will add that one to my list. Very good.
Because after about 45 minutes, it does. The endorphins kick in. There are smaller ones where they were too small to have the endorphins, and those were appreciating. But then it's a badge on my body of...
Well, that's the serotonin part. The badge is the serotonin.
Oh,
I got it. How is serotonin defined by your brain? Well, partly I'm in the one-up position vis-a-vis others because I have this, but also vis-a-vis myself, I have the confidence in my own strength, which is really what we're looking for. So I believe in myself because I have faced this particular challenge. So that's a good example. So anyway, my other books, Habits of a Happy Brain. So then there's The Science of Positivity. The subtitle is Stop Negative Thought Patterns by Changing Your Brain Chemistry. Tame Your Anxiety, Rewiring Yourself for Happiness will be out in May. Then I have the first one I wrote, which is called iMammal, How to Make Peace with the Animal Urge for Social Power. So that's the deep challenge that I hope more people will read. And I have another deep challenge book, which is called How I Escaped Political Correctness, and You Can Too.
How perfect for the climate right now.
Thank you.
And then the Inner Mammal Institute, tell us about that.
Yes. So the Inner Mammal Institute, my website, innermammalinstitute.org, has all the resources you need to make peace with your inner mammal. So I have lots of free resources, including podcasts, videos, lots of blog posts and slideshows, and a training program and infographics. And then there's a page with information about all my books, innermammalinstitute.org. Oh, and also I have on Facebook, I have a daily post. Loretta Bruning, PhD, has a post that explains different one of my resources every day. And then I have a discussion group on Facebook, Inner Mammal Institute Facebook group, where people discuss this. So I hope you'll join the discussion group.
This is so helpful.
And I also have a podcast.
Oh, what is your podcast called?
The Happy Brain. Thehappybrain.com.
First of all, your specific traumas and how you grew up and your research. And you have found a way to communicate. I love to geek out about, but a lot of people don't. You've found a way to communicate this in a way that really can help. And there's so many of us that are, it's women especially, who anxiety, depression issues, they've been labeled with brain chemistry issues that have been at the effect of the healthcare system or whatever. And you're giving us things that we can do about it and a sense of power. Thank you.
Thank you for understanding.
Okay.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much. And go sign up on Inner Mammal Institute. Dr. Bruning has emails that go out. There's like a little 5-day challenge, which is really good. And I just can't say enough about it.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to mention that. Thanks. The 5-day Happy Chemical Jumpstart. If you go to my website, there's a form will come up for a 5-day Happy Chemical Jumpstart. And what it does is each day for 5 days, you get one message that explains each of the chemicals.
Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening. Please like and subscribe and share. You can find more information about Dr. Bruning at innermammalinstitute.org. You can find me. My website is meganmriley.com and my Instagram is megan.m.riley. That's kind of fun. And Facebook is megan.m.riley0. And if you are tired of the pattern and tired of the same fight and tired of putting yourself last and tired of wondering if there's something wrong and tired of dating essentially the same person over and over and over, but just in a different meat suit, then I would really love to talk to you because this is what I do. And the women that I work with are up to some really awesome shit. And it's not only relationship. This shows up in their confidence level, how much money they make, jobs, friends with females, friends with men, in every area, even their body, things change. And so if you are ready and you are done with the pattern and you want more and you want it to be finally your time, please send me an email, mail@meganmriley.com, and we will set up a free call. I would love to talk to you.